WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're about to hear the story of a girl who grew up imprisoned by her father in a small bedroom, deprived of just about all human interaction. She wasn't exposed to language and didn't learn to speak. So when this girl, Jeannie, at the age of 13, escaped with her mother, there were many scientists who saw her as an extraordinary opportunity to learn about human development and about the parts of the brain responsible for language. My guest, Russ Reimer, has written a book that tells the story of Jeannie's desperate attempts to transcend the horrors of her childhood and the story of the researchers who thought that by studying her, they could transcend the limits of their science. Reimer's new book, Jeannie, is expanded from a series he wrote about a year ago for The New Yorker. He told me about the imprisonment and extreme deprivation Jeannie was subjected to by her father.
She spent 12 of her 13 earliest years strapped to a potty seat in the back bedroom of a suburban house outside of Los Angeles. Obviously, her father, who was the one who incarcerated her this way, was deranged. He apparently had in mind that he was protecting her, but his idea of protective custody was severe. He kept the other back bedroom of the same house reserved as a shrine for his dead mother. The rest of the family slept on mats on the living room floor. He slept in an easy chair in front of a broken television set with a gun in his lap frequently. Not what you'd call a happy or in any way normal home.
Well, Jeannie's mother was abused, too.
Yes, she had been beaten by him and was also very dependent on her husband because she was blind, or technically nearly blind. So in addition to being a passive personality, she was very handicapped and did not know how to get out of this situation. Eventually, when Jeannie was 13 years old, she did take matters into her own hands and confronted her husband, took her daughter, left the house, and that's when Jeannie emerged into the world.
What condition was she in when Jeannie and her mother walked into a welfare office?
Yes, the two of them walked into a welfare office really looking for help for Irene's blindness. Irene is Jeannie's mother. And, of course, the caseworker that she talked to was transfixed by the child because the child was so clearly infirmed. She held her hands before her as though on an invisible rail, could not walk well, had a sort of a hobbling gait, and could not communicate. The caseworker thought she might be autistic and also estimated her age at 6 or 7 years old. Jeannie at that point was 13. She could not communicate because she'd never been spoken to for all intents and purposes, and had no language. Because she had lived her entire life in the little room, she could only focus her eyes to the extent of about 12 feet. Because she had never eaten solid food, she had two complete sets of teeth.
She had her baby teeth and her adult teeth?
She had her milk teeth and her adult teeth, yeah.
She had very little in the way of language, but she did recognize the words stop it and no more.
No more.
How do you think she knew that? Do you think it was from hearing her mother say that?
Or probably her father. Her father, and part of his pathology was that he was very averse to noise. It was one of the things that he had against children. That had affected the family even before Jeannie's birth. One of Jeannie's siblings, the first child born to that couple, because she was crying, was put out in the garage where she died of exposure at the age of 2.5 months. So Jeannie, as she's incarcerated in the room in her silent life, is really not allowed to speak. And if she does have a tantrum or in any way try to express herself, she's beaten by her father.
How was it made public? How did word get out that this extraordinary young girl existed?
After the trip to the welfare office, things moved pretty rapidly. The caseworker called in a superior. The superior notified the police, and an investigation was started. And within a day, Jeannie had been admitted to Children's Hospital in Los Angeles for treatment of extreme malnutrition. And, of course, news of the bizarre case got out to the news media quickly, and started a, uh, procession of curiosity seekers driving in cars down the family's street in this suburb of Los Angeles, gawking at the house and pointing and so forth, greatly to the distress of the father and of Irene.
We should say here that the father committed suicide.
Yes, there's been a lot of questions that we would like to ask the father because, of course, he was the perpetrator of something that we find unimaginable. But we never had that chance. Clark, as was his name, was indicted on charges of criminal neglect and abuse of a minor. And on the morning of the court case, he spread out a cellophane sheet on the living room floor and shot himself through the temple with a gun that had previously belonged to his mother, leaving a note that said in part, "The world will never understand."
A lot of scientists were understandably fascinated by Jeannie and wanted to study her, particularly linguists,
yes,
because she was brought up without language. What were some of the questions that linguists were looking for answers for?
Well, in 1970, when Jeannie was discovered, she fell headlong into a raging debate among linguists. Her arrival was exquisitely timed to a pressing question that linguists were investigating about the connections between language and human biology, language, and our biological clock. Linguists wanted to know if learning to speak a first language was something only a baby knew how to do, or if it's something that we could do as teenagers or as adults, if that was when we had our first contact with a language.
And she was good person to test these theories with because she's one of the few adults that we know of who had no language.
Yes. The experiment, of course, that you could do to find out the answer to this linguistic question is what's known in science as the forbidden experiment. You cannot legally and certainly not morally lock a child in a room until they're past puberty and then let them out and see how they react. Clark, unwittingly, had done the experiment on his own daughter, and so Jeannie was a tremendous gift to linguists.
What can you say was learned about language development from studying Jeannie?
For one thing, she showed that language is intrinsic to our biology and tied to our biological clock to the point where after you pass puberty, you've lost your chance for really learning the underlying aspects of grammar and syntax that define language. Learning language is something that the human child is programmed to do. It's something that the human adult is no longer really capable of. This is learning a first language. But more startling, to me anyway, is the connection in the other direction, the connection, the ways that language forms us as human beings. Jeannie was, as it turns out, incapable of using her left hemisphere of her brain. Her left brain was functionally dead. This was not something that she was born with. It wasn't a biological handicap. It turns out that a person must receive a small amount of language at a certain early age for their brain development to be triggered. Language actually has the effect of forming us physiologically, forming our mental development. And this was clear from studies on Jeannie and has later been borne out on other children.
You know, I was just reading an article, I think it was in the New York Times, about how scientists are saying now that we don't start remembering things from childhood until we have certain language skills. Is that connected to what you're talking about?
Yes, mysteriously. You know, we have memories before we're linguistically able. But language apparently enables us to encode those memories in ways that we can then retrieve them later on. Language, in a sense, seems to be tied to the filing system for memories, which is why, if you're referring to the studies that I think you are, which is why our memories seem to begin as our language skills develop, say when we're around 3 or 3.5 years old. With Jeannie, She learned to talk, although she couldn't get grammar and syntax, the important small pieces of language that make it recognizable as conversation to most of us. She did develop tremendous vocabulary. She learned to communicate with the scientists. And one of the great questions that they had about her was, now that she has language, will she be able to remember all those things that happened to her when she had no language?
Was she able to?
She was able to, and rather horrifyingly in some cases. She would say, for instance, father hit big stick, cry, and other sentences or near sentences that let the researchers know just how she had been abused during her years in the little room. She told scientists some of her past. So apparently she did have, even though she was not very linguistic, she did have some way of encoding those memories in a way that she was able to retrieve later.
Just a little tangent here, but what we're talking about, the inability of somebody past puberty to really get the syntax of a language, mm-hmm. does that connect with why it's so hard for us adults to learn a foreign language and why young children can pick up lots of languages, you know, when they're young?
Well, young children are flexible in a variety of ways, but really a second language is a very different problem than a first. Once you have a first language, your mind has really tackled the essential chore of language learning. A second language is almost an overlay. It's interesting, the process, though, that children go through in learning language, and it seems in some ways that children are born with language. The design, underlying design of all languages is contained in our biology, genetically determined and designed in the brain. And children don't so much learn new languages as they apply their understanding of universal grammar, as it's called, to a particular language and let their understanding of other languages lapse.
My guess is Russ Reimer, author of the new book, Genie, and he had written about her in a couple of New Yorker articles just about a year ago. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guess is Russ Reimer. We're talking about his new book, Genie, which is the story of a girl who was so abused by her father that she was tied to a potty chair for the first 13 years of her life, emerged from that experience with no language at all, just a couple of words, really, and then became the subject of a lot of scientific and linguistic experiments. Let me get back to Genie's story. Were there conflicts between the goals of the research scientists and the goals of the therapists who were mm-hmm. working with her?
Yes, the problem was that those people were the same people. It was the same team, as it were, that was responsible for taking care of Jeannie and for doing the research. David Rigler and his wife Marilyn Rigler had the chore of being her foster parent and also principal investigator. So they had both roles and had to balance these competing concerns. There's a lot of debate about how well that was balanced. Not that Jeannie did not do well in their home, because it was a marvelous, warm, loving home. The problem came when the research grant ran out and Jeannie was no longer a subject of scientific scrutiny. And she was then released back to her mother and to the foster care system, where she declined rather dramatically and in a way that led to her eventual disappearance.
What were some of the other criticisms of how the scientists handled Jeannie?
There was different types of competition. Some of it was very high-minded and on a theoretical level, but other competition was on the level of jealousies, ambitions, who might get to be the person who went down in history as the sort of Anne Sullivan of Jeannie. Anne Sullivan was the woman famous for rescuing Helen Keller. Some of those rivalries ended up having a tragic outcome for Jeannie, because eventually there was a court case in which the mother, inspired partly by one of Jeannie's original caretakers, filed suit against the other scientists, claiming that they had done unethical human experimentation on Jeannie. The court case lasted for years, and the scientists were eventually exonerated. However, the animosities that grew up in that case caused Jeannie's mother to take the child, move, leaving no forwarding address for the scientists, and to disappear with her.
Does anyone know where Jeannie is now?
I do. I've talked with the mother a good bit over the last year, and she is in Southern California in a adult care home, a foster home. She is, of course, in her mid-30s now. In fact, her 36th birthday is next week. And she is happier than she was for many years because she's in apparently a much better foster home than some of those that she's been in the past. However, she is nowhere near to living up to the very hopeful promise of those early years right after her emergence when she seemed to be on such a fast track towards a normal recovery.
Were you able to visit with Jeannie?
When I first started the research for the New Yorker stories that I then expanded into the book, I called Irene, Jeannie's mother, and asked for her cooperation and also access to Jeannie, and she denied both to me, much to my dismay. I decided later that was probably a good thing for the book insofar as it made me concentrate on my real intended focus, which was to see Jeannie and the case through the eyes of all the caretakers, compatriots, scientists, researchers that had surrounded her during her emergence. Later on, Irene opened up to me. She was very helpful with the book, and I have had the opportunity of seeing Jeannie, and I have not taken it because I did not want to change the focus of the book away from those scientists. Also, there is a consideration here in that Jeannie has been observed and some would say exploited throughout her life. She was abused by her father. She was studied by scientists. I had to be sensitive to the notion that I was a third wave of exploitation, if you will. And it suited me to keep a little bit of distance from the child. Now that the book is over, I would very much enjoy meeting her.
Do you think you will?
Opportunity willing, I should hope so.
I think it's important to say here that many or most of the researchers who work with Jeannie really fell in love with her. We often rely on language as the thing that connects us to other people. She didn't have very strong language skills. What was it that made that emotional connection between the scientists and Jeannie?
Some of it, I think, probably was in the realm of language, insofar as Jeannie would say that she loved someone or would express her desires. She would say, Jeannie want live back Maryland house, or she would say, think about Mama love Jeannie. She was able to express her desires and affections. But beyond that, all the people I've talked to remark on her ability to display affection through non-linguistic ways, and not just merely in with hugs and kisses. She was demonstrative in ways that perhaps a normal linguistic person is not. She also displayed or attracted interest to her and attracted affection even from strangers on almost a spooky level. I've heard it called ESP. People would give her things that she passed on the street. Susan Curtis, the linguist that investigated Jeannie, would get up to the front of a checkout line in a supermarket and find frequently that someone else had bought something for her and something that Jeannie would like and left it with the checkout teller. One day, Susan Curtis was walking through Los Angeles, stopped at a busy intersection with Jeannie, and heard the sound of a purse being spilled. And a woman ran out of a car, stopped at the intersection, handed Jeannie the empty plastic purse, and jumped back in the car without saying a word. This was remarkable, as are so many other incidents in Jeannie's life, because Jeannie had a fascination with plastic, and especially plastic containers like purses. So without a word, she seemed to somehow have communicated to somebody that must have just gotten a glimpse of her this unusual predilection. Jeannie seemed to have almost, in some ways, a supernatural pull on people.
I don't know, maybe I'm doing the wrong thing asking you to pass judgment on somebody, but do you think that Jeannie's mother, Irene, did the wrong thing in taking her daughter away from the researchers and putting her in a foster home?
I, I suppose that's an imponderable. Certainly at that point, things had broken down. But Irene's decision was not isolated. She was working with the foster care system, with the Department of Social Services. There were many people that felt that the scientists had been remiss in addressing Jeannie's welfare and wanted to remove her from their care and to arrange other care. Now, the other care did not work out very well, but it's hard to know what would have happened if they had not taken her away. Certainly, she was almost without options as far as where to stay, who to rely on, where to place her trust in developing some kind of future.
What was it about the research that had broken down that badly?
The research originally was envisioned on as having many fronts, and because Jeannie was a difficult case, none of those fronts worked out except for the linguistic front. Understand that a lot of that not many cases like this come along. Jeannie is what they call an experiment in nature, a naturalistic case. It's not an experiment that you can sit around and design for years and then get out your beakers and flasks and go at it. She arrived. They had to make decisions. And one of the intangibles in designing the experiments to be done on Jeannie was Jeannie herself. So it's a very difficult thing to try and design proper research experiments around a child like this. There have been a number of cases over the centuries of wild children, and many of them have fared. In fact, all of the known cases have fared just about as Jeannie did.
Meaning what? That they got to a certain point and didn't get beyond that?
Well, that originally grand notions were entertained about how the child might be able to answer questions that are pressing in the world at that point, scientific or philosophical or political. And then later on, the child seems a disappointment. The people asking the questions find the too daunting the task of dealing with the complexity of this very bizarre presence, this child. And then the child eventually falls from scrutiny, is no longer of interest, and in other cases, as well as in Jeannie's case, disappears from the scene.
Russ Rimer, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Russ Rimer is the author of the new book, Jeannie. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.